There's something else I must ask of you, and you're not going to like it.
What now?
Speak, and it shall be done. If I'm ever gone, care for Ciri. She trusts you.
What?
No. What are you talking about? Instead of answering, Raven asked a question of her own. How much do you know about dragons?
I know they are dangerous. I know they have killed my people. I know it felt good when I killed one back in Faria.
She shook away her dark thoughts, because they could not be applied to every dragon, and certainly not to Ciri.
Not a lot, she admitted.
What do you know of their lifespan? Raven seemed to be going somewhere with the line of questioning, so Gwen did her best to answer.
They mature relatively slowly compared to other creatures, she said.
Almost at the same rate as humans.
Correct.
And their longevity? This one was harder to answer. She knew dragons lived long lives, like Aurians, maybe even longer. But she also knew there were many rumours about them, not the least of which was what happened to them as they outlived their human soulmates, growing multiple heads and losing their minds.
All I know is based on rumour and gossip, she hedged.
Let me enlighten you, Raven said. She spoke not with condescension, but with knowledge gained through trials and tribulations. Dragons are vibrant creatures, their minds deeper than most people know, like enormous cavern systems, full of intricacies and wonders that one can only imagine. I've been down many of Ciri's tunnels, and yet have only scratched the surface of her complexity. It was all very interesting, but why are you telling me this?
Because when a dragon bonds with another, like me, they don't know how to separate themselves from the one they've bonded with. Ciri thinks of me as her soul, as I do of her. The only difference is that if I lost her, I would be heartbroken and lost, but I would heal. Time would heal me. The opposite is true for dragons. All her caverns, her tunnels, are connected to mine. They support each other. If mine crumble, then hers will, too. Maybe not today or tomorrow. But eventually time will break her beautiful, intricate mind into rubble, leaving only one path that leads to a great chasm. Gwen was trying to understand, but it all sounded so surreal, intangible. She understood the awe that flowed beneath Ironwood because she could see it, feel it. But the mind of a dragon? It was like trying to fathom the galaxies.
What chasm?
When dragons lose their souls, Raven said, pausing to take a breath. They bridge the chasm that leads to madness.
How do you stop it?
You can't.
I don't understand. How can I promise to care for Ciri if there's no hope?
Was she actually considering doing what Raven asked?
I didn't say there wasn't hope. You can slow the spread of madness. You can encourage her to give whatever sliver of her soul that remains intact to you, but you must offer your entire self in return.
It's a lot to ask, I know, but I will, Gwen said quickly, before she'd fully considered what it meant. And then, more slowly,
I will. I swear it.
She placed a hand on Raven's shoulder.
Just then a commotion arose from outside, and a familiar, booming voice said, Stay here. I will see if the Empress is willing to— Stop!
The bones rattled as a large form burst through, grappling with several smaller forms. Sonica Vade scrambled past, skidding to a stop, her dark eyes flashing. One of the strings of bones snapped free, spilling guanic femurs and ribs across the floor.
"'Your Highness, I tried to stop them,'
Goggins said, still trying to hold two of the black tears back.
"'But they fight like my fourth wife. Dirty.'
"'It's fine, Goggin,' Raven said tiredly. Though Raven hid it well, Gwen had spent enough time around the Empress that she was beginning to be able to read the subtleties in her expression and tone of voice.
"'What can I do for you?'
"'I want to see my brother.'
"'I'm afraid that's not possible,' Raven said.
Goggin told me what he did. Let me talk to him. There must be a reason for his actions, however terrible. My brother is not a bad person, at least not the brother I remember.
Raven's eyes darted to Gwen's, and she couldn't help but feel a swell of pride that the Empress would value her opinion on matters such as this.
It will do no harm, Gwen said. But only you, and you must leave your weapons. done, Sonica said, beginning to empty her leather straps and scabbards. Knives, swords, multi-edged stars made of steel, all clanked and clattered at her feet. Collect them, Raven told Goggin, who'd released his hold on the other tiers. Keep them safe and return them to her when we're done.
I will do this thing, Goggin said.
Come, Raven said. Let us speak to your brother together. The reunion was strange. Gat and Sonica rushed to each other, hugging through the bars with a fierceness that spoke of shared loss and forgiveness and time apart and... Sonica jerked back suddenly and slapped him across the face hard enough to make an audible crack.
Why? She said. You had your freedom. I was here. The slaves are free, Gat. We could have gone home together.
Gat didn't so much as rub his cheek, which was now bright red, the distinct imprints of fingers stretching up to one eye. The slap was a mercy from a formidable woman like Sonica, Gwen realized. If even half the stories she'd heard about the woman were true, slapping was the very least of what she was capable of.
She saved my life, Gat said, gripping the bars in both hands. I owed her a life debt.
You would fight for her? Sonica said.
Once I thought I would, said Gat. But Viper Sands isn't the woman I thought she was.
There was utter sorrow in his voice, and Gwen, despite his betrayal, felt sorry for him. She knew what it felt like to be betrayed by one she cared about. One didn't live a single lifetime without being betrayed, and Gwen had lived more than one already. Gat continued, "But now my debt is paid." He turned to Raven, who hadn't said a word, standing off to the side.
"I truly am sorry. I hope you defeat her."
Raven said nothing, just nodded once. Sonica whirled around.
"What will you do to him?"
she asked. There was a challenge in her tone, and Gwen was glad she'd insisted the rebel leader leave her weapons behind. Raven said, "Release him."
"What?" Goggin said. "You can't be serious, Your Highness."
"I am. I already granted him immunity for his role in the rebellion, and he has broken no law since."
"But what he did was treason,"
Goggin insisted.
"No. He was only upholding the law, which is the same that I would have eventually done. I have no reason to hold him. Go with your sister, Gat Vade. May you find whatever it is you're looking for."
In that moment, despite everything Gwen had been through, all those she'd lost at the hands of Sand's men and women, she knew she would fight for this woman, this dark-haired raven of the desert. And, if necessary, she would die for her.
47. The Southern Empire, Fenir. Rhone Loren. Dust motes filled the air as Rhone turned the pages of a book older than anyone in the room. Though his frustration was growing as the information he desired eluded him, there was something calming about the research. It felt like that time before he learned the truth about the Western Oracle's grand plan, when he was just a man with ideals, searching for knowledge. Rhea would probably tell him he was wasting his time, when he should be focusing on repairing the broken alliance of nations. But he wanted to help Lisbeth with her newfound power. No, he thought, it was more than that. His instincts told him such a power could prove invaluable in whatever was to come. He pushed the book aside and picked up another, frowning at how the stack of books they'd already reviewed was growing, while the remaining unstudied tomes were dwindling.
"I am certain the Citadelian archives would have the answer," Lady Windy mused.
She sipped her tea daintily, her small finger in the air. Her regal air was ironic next to her unkempt hair and tea-stained frock that Rhone was certain she'd been wearing yesterday. "We aren't in Citadel," Rhone said, feeling a fool for having to point out the obvious.
"Hmm," Windy mused. "We could be there in a week by boat."
"No," Rhone said. "The battle could begin any day now. Because of the disruptions in the stream network, no one knows the exact location of the Horde."
"Men and their battles," Windy muttered.
Rhone was affronted. She knew as well as anyone that Rhone wasn't the bloodthirsty type. He loathed war as much as anyone, but that didn't mean he could pretend it didn't exist, or that it wouldn't happen.
Battle was inevitable. They had to be ready. Yila said something without looking up from the book she was reading, her brow furrowed in concentration. Neither Windy nor Rome noticed her, however, focused on their conversation. And Windy wasn't done yet.
"We've been here for more than 2 weeks already. The Horde is taking its time, murdering and pillaging and all that."
"Try not to speak about such things with too much compassion," Rone said sardonically. "One might think you have a heart." Windy smiled wryly, her lips stained brown from the tea.
"I have studied 100 battles. After a while, you must try to see the bigger picture and close yourself off from the individuals involved in them. Or you might go mad."
She waggled her eyebrows.
"This is all about the individuals involved," Rone argued, speaking over Yila, who had once more tried to say something.
"We need more scholars, not more strength," Windy said. "And all the individuals you speak of think war is the answer to every problem, from a broken shoelace to a cannibalistic army of barbarians. Would you two shut up and listen for a minute?"
Yila shouted. They both looked at Yila, surprised at her outburst. The young scholar sighed.
"I think I've found something." "Well, go on then, girl," Windy said.
Yila's finger was pressed against the page, holding her place. "Her soul delights in the conquering of others, despite the darkness. But they will not come to her, no, not when they fear the fire that burns them." Yila looked up, still wearing that frown of intense concentration. Rone wrinkled his brow. "It sounds more like a poem than anything else."
"I wasn't finished." "By the gods, you are one for drama, my dear," Windy said. "Out with it."
Yila smiled thinly, returning her attention to the page.
"She is the soul-marked, and she shall be unlike any of the others. For her power is without beginning nor ending, and she can chain them all or free them."
Rone couldn't ignore the passage now. It was a direct reference. And he suspected he knew who had written it, while his mother had dictated each word while in the throes of revelation. Bare black boots. 48. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth felt like cursing, but she didn't know any good ones. She'd been at it for hours, sitting beside the Well of Truth, hoping the memory of what she'd done when she'd saved Rone's life would allow her to recreate the power. Rone had arrived out of breath a while ago with a book, a passage of which mentioned her. The words had frustrated her. She didn't want to chain anyone.
"I want to free them," she thought,
though she wasn't certain what that meant exactly, only that it felt better than the alternative.
"Free them to do what?"
"Try again," Sir Dietrich said, ever patient with her. "A smaller stone, perhaps. Maybe something of less weight will be easier." He plucked a small, round stone from the water, placing it on a natural rock shelf set into the wall. Lisbeth stared at it, not with her eyes, which were blind, but with her third eye, which burned hotly on her forehead. The object was a dark spot amongst a dark slab, soulless hunks of stone. Spots and streaks of colour were all around it, things growing even in the harshest clime. Still, she could feel something. She concentrated harder, feeling her face begin to ache as she constricted it with her mental focus.
"Yes. Yes, this is something. I can do this."
A surge of heat rushed through her, and she almost toppled over. She would have, if not for Sir Dietrich's steady hand, suddenly clamping around her arm, holding her up.
"Lisbeth,"
he said, his concern obvious in the way he spoke her name.
"Maybe you should rest. Sit down."
"No,"
she said, though she very much wanted to.
"The rock. Did I draw it to me?"
She peered with her third eye, which was still warm, searching for that soulless black rock.
"I will not lie to you," Dietrich said. "It rests in the same spot it began. I'm sorry."
Lisbeth's heart sank.
If not to draw the rock, what had the surge of power been?
"I want to try again.
Perhaps tomorrow or the next day."
"No,"
she said. She didn't mean to snap. The thoughtful knight was only trying to protect her, as he always did.
"Yes, my lady," Dietrich said dutifully. "Perhaps if I drop the stone from a height, you will feel its peril and be able to pluck it from the ether like—" As he explained his theory, she felt the pull of a smile at the corners of her lips. This man had been a star-send since the moment he came into her mortal life, however short it had been thus far. Dietrich tried the dropping technique several times, but with each attempt the stone clattered to the ground.
"Confound it all to the stars," Lisbeth said, as the stone ricocheted into the water with a plop.
Dietrich's beautiful battered soul moved toward her. His warmth enveloped her, and she felt his rough hands on the bare flesh at the back of her neck as he pulled her against him.
"You are even more beautiful when you're angry," he said, his lips tickling her ear. "And you don't need to draw me into your arms. I shall come willingly."
When Lisbeth was still just a streak of light dancing with the stars, she'd often dreamed of having a real body, of what it would be like to feel so much. Mortality was just the space between times of immortality, or at least that was how she'd thought of it. Now, here, in this place, with this man, with these feelings, so many feelings running through her, her dreams from before felt colourless next to the true vibrancy of being human. He kissed her neck, and she tilted her head to the side to give him more room to manoeuvre, a sigh slipping from her lips. The small, breathless sound only seemed to spur him on, as he traced a path to her chin, to her lips, his tongue finding hers, devouring her as she devoured him, his hands roaming now, lower, lower, navigating the wave-like swell of her hips. Somewhere above her, the stars cheered as he laid her down gently, so, so gently. Time seemed to stop. Sir Dietrich slept, his arm curled around her as she lay nestled in the crook of his shoulder. His breathing was slow, easy, content. She felt happy, which immediately made her feel selfish, which immediately made her feel sad. From the moment she fell from the stars to inhabit this wonderfully imperfect body, she dragged death and destruction behind her like a heavy load. Ever since the sleeping nights had been destroyed, she felt strange, hollow. And yet, with Dietrich, she was happy. Why should she be happy when so many others had already suffered at her hands? One soul in particular troubled her more than any others. He was one of the Ghazi, the tribe that occupied the northern hinterlands, and his name came to her, Zer, as did his soul, as dark grey and tremulous as shifting shadows. A man with demons. She remembered what she'd seen when she'd probed his soul, the willing sacrifice of a girl she now knew to be his daughter, her life given to the monster god of the frozen lake they relied upon to quench their thirst and feed their thousands. "Their thousands," she thought, swiftly pushing the idea away. She had hurt them simply by appearing in the hinterlands. Even if she could bridge the hundreds of miles between she and them, she could not ask anything of them. Not even Crone, the kindly old Ghazi woman who'd taken Lisbeth in, sheltered her and fed her while she tried to come to terms with who and what she was. Lisbeth breathed, and she saw them in her mind. Nestled amongst dark cliffs capped in snow, the Ghazi's ice-block hut stood sentinel. Females moved amongst them, some carrying younglings bundled in skins and furs, others drawing carts laden with supplies or wood. They moved with a gritty determination that told of the strength of a people who'd long lived under harsh climatic conditions. And yet she felt their fear, too.
"Why?" she wondered. "Did I cause it? Or do they sense what has arrived in our lands, the great horde gathering beyond their borders?"
With a start, she realized she wasn't observing them as a star might, with omniscient, all-seeing power. No, she was watching through the eyes of another, her own soul slipping inside one that was familiar to her. The last time she'd touched Zer's soul, she had harmed him. Then she'd had little control over her fate mark. Now the grace of her technique left the Ghazi warrior oblivious to her presence. She hadn't even meant to inhabit him, but once she'd touched a soul, she was always connected to it. These people had the luxury of peace, and she wouldn't strip it from them. That's when she realized she was no longer gazing upon the working people,
but staring at the snow, watching a tendril of viscous blood ooze into a puddle. Xur was groaning, rocking back and forth, back and forth.
"Oh, gods, what have I done?"
She already knew. Her thoughts had betrayed her. She'd shown him everything. The hoard, the danger these lands were in. And she had, at long last, broken him. Xur. Voices murmured around him. Though they spoke Ghazi, a language that usually sounded as poetic to his ears as the sight of hope flowers against a snowy backdrop, now their words sounded harsh, guttural barks from the back of their throats. It was because of her, he knew. Lisbeth Lorne, the mysterious human who had appeared like a wraith in the hinterlands, only to steal their frozen warriors and depart like a ghost in the night. He'd felt many emotions toward the Blue One. Hatred, anger, resentment, embarrassment, frustration. And then, the biggest surprise, relief. Not that she'd left, but that she'd stolen his secrets. Ever since she'd probed through his mind, his soul, viewing the most intimate parts of him even as she tore away his hidden armor, he'd felt the relief of a burden shared with another. The weight of his past, his unbearable loss, had lifted, and he'd felt free, he said in the tongue of his people.
Xur,
one of his captains said, a great warrior called Hergaz.
You fell. You were speaking nonsense. About invaders and war and death.
Xur tried to reply, but his mouth was as dry as heated stone, his lips crinkled like bark. He did, however, manage to get one word out.
Horde.
49. The Southern Empire, Fenir. Rhône Lorraine. No more lies, no more secrets. Rhône knew he had to tell them the last of that which he'd been holding back, waiting for the right time that was a figment of his own imagination. The leader of the Horde, this Clar Gra, he started, pausing for no reason but to delay. This truth had almost broken his spirit, and he was afraid of what it might do to his last remaining allies, like a gust of wind scattering a pile of leaves over a great distance. He'd gathered them together, but not for a fate-marked council, for that had been the wrong name. This time he called it the Council of the Four Kingdoms, though not every nation was represented any more. Across from him, Lisbeth Lorne's milky eyes watched his hands, and he realized they were rolling over each other nervously. She clasped them together, held them firm. Beside Lisbeth, Sir Dietrich's expression was an unreadable mask. Further down the table, Rhea held her sleeping babe, cradling her in her arms. Grey Aris was close at hand, always attentive, his blade hand resting casually on the table. Directly beside Rhône were the half-marked Shay and Eric, who met his eyes with interest. On his opposite side was Falcon Hoser, a man who continued to impress Rhône. Windy and Yeela had begged off in the name of scholarship. Neither were content with the brief reference they'd found to Lisbeth Lorne's mysterious power, and they were determined to continue their research. Noticeably absent was Shanti Parthena Lord, who hadn't been seen for several days. The rest of the large council table felt terribly empty, the power of those who weren't there almost as formidable as those who had stayed. The biggest surprise, however, was the shadowy figure of Bane in the corner, one leg bent, his foot pressed against the wall. Rhône had invited him to sit, but he'd refused. Rhône realized that his pause had carried long past the point of awkwardness. Even Rhea had turned her attention from her daughter to stare at him. He cleared his throat. Started again. "The leader of the Horde is fate-marked," he said. He marveled at how easy it had been to speak those words, when learning them had been an adventure too unbelievable for even the most imaginative of the bards to sing about.
"What?"
It was Sir Dietrich who spoke, his eyes sharpened to deadly points.
"You thought only to tell us this now. Had we known earlier?"
He didn't need to finish his thought, for Rhône's were the same. Perhaps we could have convinced the others to stay.
"I'm sorry. I was afraid of what it might do to—"
The excuse fell from his lips. There was no excuse. If he was them, he would be angry. Knowledge was crucial in this world, and he'd kept this piece of it to himself, telling only Gareth in confidence.
"Do you know what this means?"
The question came from Roan's left, from Shae Arris, whose bright brown eyes were filled with an intensity he'd only seen one other time, when she'd used her power to bolster his strength in the bloody canyons.
"Shae," Grey said, a note of warning in his tone. "No," Shae said. "This is our decision."
And there it was, one of the many reasons Roan had withheld the information. Bane said,
"What am I missing?"
"Not much," Rhea said. "Only that Shae and Eric might sacrifice themselves to kill Clar Gra. Only it will also mean that all of the other Fate-marked will die too. That includes you."
Silence hung for a moment, but then faded as several whispered side conversations began. Roan cut into them. "I wanted all of you here, not just the Fate-marked. But it doesn't change that this is a Fate-marked decision, and it must be unanimous."
"Even him?" Sir Dietrich said, nodding toward Bane.
"Yes," Roan said without hesitation. "And we will need to receive a response from Gwendolyn Storm, too."
"I get a vote, too," Rhea said. "And I vote no. It's not happening."
She glared at Shae and Eric, her eyes dancing between them. Now it was Roan who felt like he was missing something, though his confusion was mirrored by everyone else at the table, even Grey.
"Why do you get a vote?" Grey asked.
Her eyes met his and stayed there. Roan suddenly felt as if he were intruding on a private conversation.
"Because, dear Grey, our daughter is fate-marked, too."
"Why didn't you tell anyone?" Roan asked.
What he really meant was, "Why didn't you tell me?" The council had been paused so that everyone could digest the information, with the agreement to reconvene the following day. Shae Arris and Eric, moving with impressive speed on his crutches, had slipped away quickly. Grey had muttered a curse and given chase. Lisbeth and Sir Dietrich had stayed sitting exactly where they were, while Falcon had said something about looking for Shanti. Bane had simply disappeared, though his shadow had remained for a moment before fading too. Roan, on the other hand, had gone to his sister, to Rhea, requesting a word in private. Now they sat on the edge of her bed in her quarters.
"Do you want to see?" she replied,
not answering his question. He couldn't help himself. His excitement was palpable, thrumming through him like a restless energy. All his studies of the Fate-marked seemed a fool's errand next to the living child, sleeping in her mother's arms.
"Yes," he said,
the greatest understatement of his life.
"Please, bring a torch."
He did, careful not to drop it from his trembling hands, steering it closer, closer. Rhea unwrapped the blanket covering the child's skin, and then light bloomed, not from one place only, but from everywhere, illuminating markings on the babe's arms, legs, stomach, and even its face. They were people and creatures, races and sigils and places and events. They were history, past, present, and future. Roan didn't know how he knew this, but he did, as clearly as he knew he was the life-marked spoken of in the Western Oracle's prophecy. The images danced and shifted, unlike the static marking on his own chest. The child stirred, and though he didn't want to, Roan moved back, watching as the markings faded into perfect, unmarred flesh.
"What do they do?" he asked,
aware of the awe in his every word. Rhea laughed lightly.
"Froth, take me to the seventh heaven if I know," she said. "But when I first looked upon them, a voice spoke to me."
"What voice?"
"Froth? One of the other gods? The Western Oracle, perhaps? How should I know?"
"What did the voice say?"
"The peace marked. At long last, she has come,"
Rhea recited, and a shiver ran down Roan's spine.
"And I didn't tell you earlier, because I know how you are."
Roan was about to protest, but he stopped. She had a point, which he was proving at this very moment.
"You were trying to protect her."
"Of course. I'm her mother. I know you think I'm a monster,
But even a monster loves her own monstrous children, regardless of whether they come out as angels, like this little one.
I don't think you're a monster. Well, maybe once, but not any more. Rhea laughed again, and this time the child's eyes fluttered open and she yawned, her little hands fisted as she stretched.
Good to know. I don't want to hurt your little angel,
Roan said.
No? Even if it meant bringing peace to the Four Kingdoms. Isn't that your sole purpose in life?
Roan shook his head, but he stopped himself, wanting to be certain of his own mind before answering. I would die if it meant peace. I would let others die if they were willing. Che Aris, Eric Clawborne, Sir Dietrich, Lisbeth Lorne. Even Gwendolyn Storm, he knew, even if the thought brought an ache to his chest. But this child, the peace-marked, at long last she has come, was not supposed to die, was she? He knew the Western Oracle was as ruthless as she was determined to restore peace, but she wouldn't require such a thing to be on the back of a newborn babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. Would she?
No,
Roan said. But it was his answer, and not the Oracle's. No. I swear I will protect my niece above all others, even if it destroys us all. Rhea's smile faded partway through his answer, and emotion flashed across her face.
I'm sorry I haven't been a better sister. I wish things could have been different, that we'd grown up together.
Her words were spoken with such earnestness that Roan's eyes watered. But there was no point wishing for a different world. No, they had to make one themselves. The child smiled, and Roan smiled back, making a funny face. Roan couldn't help it. It was kind of nice knowing more than the two scholars for once.
You look like a dog who just dug up a bone,
Windy said.
Tea?
She held a long-handled pot in the air. Yes, please, he said, though he only said it to avoid an argument over the benefits of the foul concoction. While Windy poured him a sludgy cup, he said, There's another fate marked we didn't know about. His words had the intended effect. Windy stopped mid-pour, nearly spilling the tea, and Yila looked up from her reading. Roan knew it was he who was being dramatic now, but he let the silence extend as the information sunk in. Windy, however, was never patient when it came to knowledge.
If you don't tell us this instant, I'm going to dump the contents of this pot over your head.
Rhea's daughter, Roan said. Windy's eyes lit up like she'd just been given a prestigious scholarship award.
Yes, she said. I remember something.
What?
Yila
asked.
There was no mention of a child anywhere in the literature. There was, Windy said, but I didn't tell you, either of you.
Roan gripped the table, trying hard to keep his voice even. What are you talking about? This was becoming a pattern with Lady Windy, who believed in the literal meaning of knowledge is power. Hoarding information like a miser might collect sacks of gold.
I've got it somewhere,
Windy said, scrounging around in the several pockets on the outside of her dirty frock.
Ah, there.
She extracted a torn scrap of parchment, pinched between thumb and forefinger. Yila audibly gasped. She seemed more shocked by the fact that her tutor had defaced a book than anything else.
What does it say?
Roan asked, fearing his firm grip might break chunks off the edge of the wooden table. Windy quoted from the scrap.
Preceding the fall of all things, a child shall be born, and she shall be marked with peace, the bringer of death before life, tragedy before triumph, and the final rulers shall fall. They shall fall. Such is their fate.
Windy looked up.
Kind of pessimistic, don't you think?
50. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Che Aris.
You heard what I heard, Eric said. What Roan Loren showed us.
Yes,
Che said, trying to think. She was counting lives. Hers, Eric's. Others too.
Roan and Lisbeth, and Sir Dietrich and Gwendolen, and, yes, even Bane. 7. A lucky number, some would say. 7 deaths to save the 4 kingdoms. But 7 was wrong, for there was another now. A child.
"Stop thinking about her like she's someone else's baby," she thought fiercely. "She's Grey's. She's your niece."
"Shay," Eric said. She knew what he would say, that she needed to take emotion out of the decision, needed to think about things logically. 8 deaths? After all the war, the killing, the blood spilled and vengeance wrought, 8 versus the multitudes should have been an easy decision. Instead, it was impossible.
"We can't do this," she said.
"We must consider it."
"Must we?" she snapped. "Because I thought we already had, back in Pirate's Peril. We agreed it was too drastic, that the failsafe was created by the Oracle to be used as a last resort."
Eric's voice was so calm it was infuriating, and Shay wondered if this was how Grey had felt after he'd been reunited with her, only to realize that she had changed into a stranger he had to get to know all over again.
"Everything is different now. Bane was a known threat, and he was acting alone. But this man, this leader of the Horde, he has an army. You saw what Lisbeth showed us. You saw the darkness in their hearts. They have no compassion, no mercy. If we fight them, even if all the fate-marked and nations ally themselves together, thousands will die. Maybe tens of thousands. I'm only asking the question, are we willing to sacrifice so many when we could end everything right now?"
Shay's wall crumbled.
Oh, Grey, this world is a harsh place and getting harsher. I don't know.
51. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Shanti Parthena Lord. Shanti had been running from the harsh truths of a harsher world her entire life. When her entire family had been enslaved, she'd fought back. When she'd been abused, she'd vowed vengeance. When they'd taken her family from her, she'd put that vengeance into action, breaking the slave master's magical chains, which no others had been able to break. But now, Shanti could run no longer. Hiding wasn't an option either, for she'd seen the truth. They'd freed the slaves. They'd defeated the slave-loving Phoenicians. They'd accomplished the impossible. And yet it wasn't enough. Was never enough. Jai Jiru had still died. The Horde was still coming to destroy them all. She still remembered the images cast into her mind by Roan and Lisbeth. The barbarians moved with unspent violence. They would not kill with mercy, instead drawing out each murder with pleasure. In particular, she sensed, they would delight in the deaths of the hundreds of Phoenician and Terran children she now watched playing in the canyons. Shadows sliced across the terrain as the sun moved on, each seeming to impale one of the children. "A swift death is a mercy," she thought. "The only mercy we have left." Procuring the fire route had been too easy. Her position as lead engineer of all things explosive proffered her a certain level of trust amongst those guarding the supplies, including the powder. Once, the sacks of fire root had been used by the slaves in the mines, blasting away rock to discover precious metals and gemstones. "Now it will be our salvation," she thought, watching the ghosts moving amongst the children in the canyon below. She tried not to think about what Jai would think of her, because that didn't matter now, right? He was dead. Gone. Nothing could bring him back. Shanti placed another satchel of fire root powder in the small cave she was watching from, careful to hide it behind a jutting rock. It was the 50th she'd planted already. Only a couple hundred more to go, and then her work would be finished. "And then I shall save them all," she thought. 52. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Rhea Loren. Rhea felt electrified, like lightning was running through her. She was also having trouble breathing. The former was because she'd finally shared her secret about Nura's fate mark. The latter was because of the fear of losing her.
So innocent, she thought. She wished the world could be a different place, a place safe for her daughter to grow up in. Then again, Rhea also knew she had helped to create this very world. Nora was an angel sleeping, and Rhea could almost see the outlines of her wings folded around her. She laughed lightly at her own imagination. The torch set close to the bassinet danced from a light breeze, flashing its light across the sleeping babe. Images flared from her cheek, but then the torchlight moved on, and her skin was just skin again. "Why her?" she wondered, for the thousandth time. "After everything, why does it have to be my daughter?" Rhea took a deep, shuddering breath. It had to be somebody's daughter. The better question was, why not mine? Rhea thought of the good people she had known in her life. Loyal, honourable people who always seemed to do the right thing. Ennis, Roane, Gareth Ironclad, even Gwendolyn Storm. All people who would make the right choice if Nora were their child. "She isn't just yours," she thought. "She's his, too." The thought gave her some comfort, because, yes, Grey was good. Pure-hearted. Maybe not the old Grey, back when he was the rapscallion grease jolly, but the new Grey. "I've changed, too," she thought, trying not to forget the cold-hearted snake she'd been back in Night's End. But was the woman she'd become enough? Her question remained unanswered, as Grey slipped into the room without knocking. He seemed to realize his error, because he froze and said, "Sorry, I didn't want to wake her." For a moment, Rhea couldn't speak. He looked so perfect, dashing, like the prince she could never have. There was no blade on his missing hand, just a leather sheath. She just stared at him, feeling an ever-widening gulf between them, despite the tender moments they'd already shared. Because he would want to do the right thing with Nora, allow the Fate Mark to study her and determine whether she could help them against the Horde. Grey moved so quickly she didn't have time to react, to consider whether she should stop him or flee or pretend to be ill or... His arms were around her, and his lips pressed against hers, and she felt that familiar feeling of falling for a boy who was no longer a boy, but a man, strong and experienced, scooping her up as if she weighed less than a feather, and carrying her to bed while their child slept nearby. Every touch was tender, and he didn't try to go further than he should, not so soon after childbirth, when her body was still sore. Tears streamed down her face as he kissed her, touched her, and eventually he felt the hot wetness between them. He pulled back, his brow knitted with concern, and she felt it, the true feeling behind the concern, driving his every action in this moment. Love. "What's wrong?" he said. "Did I hurt you?" "By the gods," she thought, her heart beating furiously. "Why are you crying when this man loves you? Why are you so unbearably sad when you have everything you could ever want in a man and a child and a life?" And she knew, because she loved him, too. So she lied, because it was the only way to hide her true intentions from the one person she never wanted to lie to, not ever again. She lied, because it was the only way to save their daughter. "Nothing," she said. "And no. You've done nothing wrong. I'm just happy. So, so happy." He smiled at her false words, and she hated herself as he leaned in to kiss her once more.
53. The Southern Empire, Fenir. Shae Arrys. Having the power to save the world was proving more complicated than Shae could ever imagine. More so because she shared the responsibility with a one-legged pirate king who liked to analyze every angle of every problem, until the problem began to look like the solution, and the solution began to resemble day-old porridge, a congealed, unrecognizable mess.
"So you think we should do it?" Shae asked, hating herself for even considering the possibility. "I didn't say that," Eric said, running a hand through his long, sandy brown hair.
Recently he'd begun wearing it draped across his shoulders rather than tied back. It made him look older, somehow. I said we should continue to weigh our options. Shay knew he wasn't trying to be difficult, only practical. Whereas she relied more on faith and instinct, he went into his head. Usually it was a good dynamic where they arrived at the same answer swiftly, like back in Pirate's Peril or in the Bloody Canyons. Usually. But not now. "Here are our options," she said. "We end it right here, right now." She couldn't believe she was saying it, but someone had to. Eric opened his mouth to object, but she pressed a finger to his lips to silence him. It didn't feel awkward, because they touched often to feel the power they shared. Every touch was purely platonic. He was far too old for her. But it didn't change the fact that she felt something pure when they held hands, or fell asleep at each other's sides. "Or," she continued, drawing her finger back, "we stay the course, support the fate marked in the coming battle. If the battle turns against us, we will still have the option to finish it. A last resort, like we always planned." Eric shook his head. "We can only use our power to strengthen the fate mark thrice in short succession," he said. "Lower your voice," she said, though they were alone. It was a secret they had only just learned themselves. During the fight for the Bloody Canyons, they'd strengthened Roan, then Lisbeth, and with their hands clasped tightly together, their energy sapped. Their eyes had met, and they'd both known the truth. One more surge of power, and they would both be fully drained. In the days since the battle, they'd felt as their energy, their power, was replenished. But they also knew the same rules would apply the next time. "We should tell them the truth," Eric said. It was an argument they'd had on multiple occasions, but so far they'd agreed not to. "No," Shay said. "They don't need to know. It might sway their minds on how to proceed, and we can't have that." "Fine. But we can't end it now, either. Even if all the other Fate Marked agreed to it, we can't kill a child." Shay wanted to argue, because what was one life, or even 100 lives, next to the fate of the entirety of the 4 kingdoms? "But if we kill this one child in the name of peace, then what the hell are we fighting for?" "So we strengthen the fate marked in battle," she said. "That is our decision. Agreed?" Eric didn't respond for a long time. Not until she took his hand in hers, immediately feeling that warmth, that energy streaming between them. Until they felt of one mind. "I don't know," he said. And the spell was broken. 54. The Southern Empire, Calypso. Raven Sands. It was the eve before she would face her aunt in the arena, and Raven couldn't sleep. Whisper burst into her room, bones clanking at the doorway. She stood there for a moment, her chest heaving, like she'd run a long way. Her hands were fisted at her sides. She wore full battle leathers, her waist regaled with all manner of weaponry. Their eyes met, and Raven felt like she was looking into the eyes of not only a sister, but a dear friend. They'd been through so much together in such a short time. Pain, loss, victory. Survival. Theirs was a life of extremes. "You are the most beautiful sandswoman I have ever laid eyes on," Raven said. "I don't want to be beautiful," Whisper said. "Well, you are. You always will be." Raven took the first step to cross the gulf between them, because, after all, she was still the eldest. She had to be strong for Whisper, even when she was strong for herself. "I'm going to kill Gatvade," Whisper said. Raven continued walking, opening her arms. "No, you're not." She drew Whisper's body against hers. Though her sister's body had developed the curves of a woman grown, she could feel the muscle and bone, the strength. Her sister stiffened, her arms taut at her sides, but then, slowly, she relaxed, roping her own arms around Raven's back. "I love you, sister. I hope you know that," Raven said softly. "I do," Whisper said. "And I, you. More than anything in this godforsaken world." "Don't say that," Raven said.
Why not? It's true. If you die on the morrow, I won't.
It was a half-lie, Raven knew. Though she would fight to the death in the arena, she couldn't promise she would emerge alive. They broke off their embrace, and Raven looked upon the changed face of a girl who'd become a woman in the pits of Zune. Though Whisper's hair was pulled back and tied, she could still tell it had been washed and combed. She was smooth locks to Raven's coarse hair, soft skin to Raven's calloused and scarred, gentle curves to Raven's hard edges. And yet she was as fierce as any. She'd proven that in the pits, a sands through and through.
"I am proud of you, sister," Raven said. "Are you?"
There wasn't anger in her tone exactly, but doubt. Raven tasted bitterness on her tongue. She deserved such a response. For too many years she'd underestimated her youngest sibling, simply because she liked feminine dresses and pretty colours and colourful flowers and—
"Yes,"
Raven said.
"So proud."
Something changed in Whisper's demeanour, and for a moment, a bare, naked moment, she was the young, innocent girl Raven remembered. The moment passed, and Whisper stuck out her jaw.
"That, above all else, means the world to me," she said.
Raven felt the weakness in her knees, but she would not break, not in front of her sister. Showing strength was the one gift she'd always been able to give Whisper.
"I need you to promise me something," Raven said. "Anything. If I die tomorrow—" "You won't. You said it yourself."
Whisper's eyes were those of a wildcat, not to be denied of its prey.
"I know. But if I do, promise me you won't close yourself off from the world." "Raven, you're not going to—"
Raven grabbed her sister's chin, forced her to look directly into her eyes.
"Promise me."
Whisper didn't so much as blink as she said,
"I promise."
Raven pulled her into another hug, the sound of bones clinking softly nearby as starlight illuminated their embrace. Later, on the same sleepless night, footsteps jarred Raven from her thoughts. They were muffled, as if the intruder was trying to be quiet but doing a lousy job of it. Her guards should have stopped anyone dangerous, but she wasn't willing to risk it, so she stole from bed to the door, sliding soundlessly into the shadows. Darkness obliterated the moon's light through the cracks in the threaded guanic bones. A large form, big enough to fill the entire doorway. Had her aunt managed to send an assassin to do her dirty work for her? Or was this someone acting of their own volition, someone who hated the sands and all they stood for? Anything was a possibility at this point. A large, powerful hand slipped through the bones, parting them. An arm followed, then a foot and leg and shoulder and head. Raven exploded from hiding, leaping high enough to slam an elbow down on the back of the massive man's neck. He released a grunt and stumbled forward as she landed behind him. He started to turn, but she was already moving forward, stamping down hard on his foot and bringing a knee up into his groin area. He gasped and doubled over just in time for his chin to meet her fist as it swung up in a vicious uppercut, just as green moonlight slipped through the gap in the bones and fell across his face.
"Shite,"
Raven muttered, watching as Goggin dropped to one knee, clutching his midsection.
"Like all my ex-wives rolled into one,"
he said, his voice raspy and breathless.
"You damn fool,"
Raven said, rushing over to him.
"What were you doing slinking around like a thief in the dark?"
She put her hand on his shoulder and he winced, as if he thought she might strike him again.
"I wanted to make sure you were okay,"
he said, taking sharp, whistling breaths between words. Raven cursed under her breath. It was just the sort of thing the big brute would do. He was selfless to a fault, even if she could hear the rocks rattling around in his skull at times.
"Come on, lie down," she said. "Rest for a minute."
A devilish smile curled his broad lips.
"Are you inviting me to bed?"
She swatted him.
"I've just assaulted your manhood and you'd proposition me?"
Gritting his teeth against the obvious pain he was in, he said,
"You can assault my manhood any time, and I will proposition you any way you want.
Despite herself, Raven shook her head.
If I didn't know any better, I'd say you were declaring your love for me.
It was meant to be a jape, but Goggin's face suddenly turned serious.
I am Empress.
He flashed a grin.
And offering my body for your pleasure.
Raven scoffed. Is that the line that got you all your wives?
Aye, so long as I kept them drinking Simpra.
Raven didn't know what to make of any of this. Was he being serious? Was he joking? More than anything, she was trying to figure out which she hoped for.
What the hell is wrong with me? Goggin? Really?
Yes, she'd known him for a long time and considered him a friend, but why did she suddenly feel hot all over at his nearness?
I am about to fight to the death in the arena, and you thought it a good time to tell me this.
Goggin seemed to be recovering slightly, his body straightening. One of his strong hands reached forward, settling on her hip.
I have faced drowning and death, dehydration and monsters made of blood and sand. Next to those things, love is a kindness I will not waste.
Raven tried to hide the quiver in her voice as she said,
Why, Goggin, you almost sounded poetic there.
His fingers seemed to burn through the thin night shift she wore.
Did I? Must be the Simpra talking.
Despite his talk of strong drink, she could not smell it on his breath. And to her surprise, Raven wanted to kiss him. Denying herself this was the only kindness she had left to offer the big man. For on the morrow she might die, and she would not allow his heart to die with her.
Goggin, she said,
wishing his hand would move from her hip so she would not have to remove it herself. Wishing it wouldn't. Wishing his lips would stop her words. Wishing she could speak them faster. Wishing for more time.
I do not love you, she said, plucking his hand from her hip. Not like that. Thank you for your offer, but no. I shall rest alone on this night.
He tried to hide it, but she could see the pain on his face, deeper and more powerful than the physical pain she'd already wrought upon him.
As you wish, he said,
pushing to his feet, avoiding her touch as she tried to help him. He bowed stiffly.
May you conquer on the morrow.
She said nothing as he turned and lumbered back into the night, for her mouth was full of sand and regret, her eyes blinded by tears. After all the waiting, all the stewing, Raven was glad when the day dawned hot and bright. She bathed in cool water, but as soon as she emerged from the tub, she started to sweat again. Gwen was waiting within her quarters. To her surprise, Whisper was, too. The women stood on opposite sides of the room, but at least they were both there. Before either of them could speak, Raven said,
I can dress myself.
We know, Whisper said. But we're going to help you anyway, Gwen finished. Something unspoken passed between the women, and Raven shook her head.
They're finishing each other's sentences, and Goggin is declaring his love for me. Perhaps the world truly has gone mad.
As you wish, Raven said. But be prepared to lose a finger or two. My teeth are sharp.
See? Whisper said to Gwen. She's always been like this. Too tough for her own good.
Gwen said,
Luckily we outnumber her, and we've got weapons.
She held up a bone-tooth comb. Whisper followed her lead, showing Raven the leather belt in her hands. Raven sighed and resigned herself to her fate. Half an hour later, Gwen and Whisper escorted her to the pyramids.
Wait here, Raven said,
and, thankfully, this time they didn't challenge her. Ciri was waiting inside, not curled and sleeping like Raven expected, but resting on her powerful hind haunches, her wings half open. Her crimson scales shimmered darkly under the torchlight. She growled, not because of Raven's arrival, but because of what she was unable to hide in her mind.
I know, my soul, Raven said, extending her hand.
The dragon unfurled its long neck to nuzzle its face against her palm. Ciri's eyes were closed, as if at peace, but that growl continued to rumble from her lips.
I would kill Viper, Ciri said.
Dragons, Raven knew, didn't make threats.